This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Today, we'll chat with the founder and music director of Harmony Ensemble New York, Stephen Richman. What began nearly 40 years ago as, what their name implies, a harmonie, a wind ensemble, grew into a chamber orchestra playing great European classical music, to a focus on American music of Copland and Gershwin, to now making highly acclaimed recordings of music from other American avenues and composers such as Duke Ellington, Gil Evans, and Henry Mancini, and searching to get back to a style that is close to the source for this deeply American music, as a calling card for my guest and his ensemble is uncovering rare gems and original orchestrations. My guest began career as a French horn player, so his bond with his musicians is strong. But soon after founding the group in 1979, they caught a break in being engaged to play at the celebration of the 80th birthday of Aaron Copland. That's my guest and his group performing the fourth movement, Burlesque, from Copland's Music for the Theater. I spoke with Stephen Richman at his apartment in New York City a few weeks back. Stephen Richman. The group is nearly 40 years old. You were just saying 38 years.
So unbelievably.
40's going to be here in a blink.
I'm hoping for 40 and I'm hoping for 50.
Just to start there, sort of the nature of the ensemble today as it is, was that what you always wanted it to be? Was that the plan? It seems like, and correct me if I'm wrong, that when you started in 79, there was emphasis on it, a more classical, Euro-classical ensemble. You had a lot of success. Pick a composer. I mean, the Dvorak Association recognized you and all this kind of stuff. So, I mean, the arc of where it is, I mean, was it that we were hoping back then? Or just give us that.
Not at all. The name of the group, Harmony Ensemble, yeah. New York, Harmony with an I-E, that's the historic word for classical wind ensembles,
right,
of the late 18th, early 19th century. So that's what I started out doing way back in the beginning of symphony space in, unbelievably, 1979. But I also did chamber orchestra there. There was a Copland 80th birthday concert,
right,
at Symphony Space in 1980, which was, we could have a discussion about that for an entire day, I think. But Bernstein was there, and there were some infamous things that happened with Bernstein, which I will not go into right now. There was a line around the block, you know, of people the entire day, and I went on at 10 o'clock. So I got to work with Copland for an entire week, and they warned me that he was having memory issues. I'm beginning to appreciate and sympathize with this much more at this point. So I got to work with him. I conducted my group in a chamber orchestra, music for the theater, and he attended my rehearsals, and he conducted Harmony Ensemble New York in Appalachian Spring. And I think, I can't remember if it was the suite or the complete ballet, but he was having problems remembering very simple things. So came the concert, and Bernstein came up and gave this very interesting speech. So I conducted music for the theater, and as I was walking off stage, Copeland was sitting there in the wings in between curtains, and it was completely dark, and I almost tripped over him. And he looked up at me, and he said, "That was the best performance of music for the theater I ever heard." He said, "Did you conduct it?" And I thought he was kidding, because we had been working on it. And I said, "Yes, Mr. Copeland, remember, this is Steve, you know." And yeah. "Oh, yes, yes, yes." But then he went on to conduct this glorious performance of Appalachian Spring, which is far superior to the commercial recording. So that was chamber orchestra. Then we did some orchestra concerts. I mean, I did Beethoven Fifth, you know, I did Siegfried Idol. And it's just kind of evolved, and this is totally unplanned. So I began doing Gershwin at Lincoln Center in the late 80s, and I was given permission by the Gershwin family to have access to the original manuscripts, which was thrilling, to say the least. And I spent a couple of weeks down there in Washington, and I noticed that there were significant differences between the published versions and his manuscripts.
Save that. We're going to get to that. I don't want to get too far past the Copeland, because 1 year in with your ensemble, I mean, you got to look back at that Copeland event and say, wow. I mean, the timing of that was just perfect, right? That it happened, and you could focus the group, and the group got exposure. And I mean, timing is everything, right? At least in the theater. So, I mean, do you look back at it now and say, I don't know what the group would have been had we not been able to do that Copeland 80th?
You know how things happen.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, in that particular case, it was completely serendipity. The people at Symphony Space said, "Oh, by the way, we're doing this Copeland birthday concert." I said, "Well, I would very much like to be involved with that."
Right.
I don't remember the exact conversation. "I'd love to conduct music for the theater. It's been one of my favorites ever since a Bernstein recording on a famous record called Humor and Music." And these things just kind of grew one out of the other, you know. I'm always going in a completely different direction, you know. And then I got into a whole bunch of other things. What I was trying to do was record Gershwin's music, his orchestral music,
right,
as close as possible to what he wrote within reason. Because there were many editors and publishers who thought they were going to correct errors in quotes. And they were, to a certain extent, they were right, but mostly they were very wrong. And they did a great disservice. So I said, I'm hoping, you know, at some day, you know, to record most of this stuff. And sometimes it takes me 20 years to get around to this.
So as the group, I mean, like I said, you did some really fine and acclaimed recordings of Eurocentric classical music, whether it's Dvorak, whatever, Grieg, whatever. As the years went on and you started to move not only to American music, but different styles, bringing in jazz idioms and things like that, did you have to sort of mold and... Because that's a different calling for a type of player than you had. I mean, you have a French horn background, but has the group over the years, because you've taken these different paths, you've had to sort of rethink who's in the group and what makes up who, what kind of musician, that they can straddle the fence and go both sides, jazz, classical, and such?
Well, absolutely. And it's hard to make a generalization. It's generally two separate groups of musicians. Occasionally, there's a, you know, slight overlap with some saxophone players who may play, for instance, in a Gershwin orchestra. But as I said, this developed, you know, rather spontaneously. I think it was the jazz program director at St. Peter's, the jazz church in New York, came to one of my concerts. We did Lincoln Center, we did Carnegie Hall, we also had a series at Madison Avenue Presbyterian Church, where I would do a chamber concert and an orchestra concert. And I believe it was the Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony that this fellow came to my concert, and we struck up a conversation afterwards. And he says, "Well, you know, I run the jazz series, you know, anything you'd like to do?" I said, "Well, there's a lot of Gershwin I'd like to do. And there's a whole bunch of things I'd like to do." So we started on this. I think we're in the sixth or seventh year now. And the following year, he says, "What would you like to do?" I said, "How about Sketches of Spain?" You know, I said, "You know, my uncle, Bernie Glow, played lead trumpet on that recording back in 59 and 60. I was a little kid, and I would hear all these amazing stories, and there's these photographs of him, you know, with Miles Davis. And well, that'd be an interesting thing to do." So I always get to meet the families. I was introduced to Gil Evans' family.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still in touch with his wife and his two sons. I mean, I know the Stravinskys, I know the Dvoraks.
The Gershwins, you know.
The Gershwins very well. One of my fantasies is to get all the families together on the stage of Alice Tully Hall in New York and introduce them to each other and then play the music by their forebears, you know.
from my guest Stephen Richman and his Harmony Ensemble New York's recording of Nutcracker Suites, both Tchaikovsky, and the arrangement of that ballet music by Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn, here is their version of The Dance of the Reed Pipes, here called Toot Toot Tootie Toot.
Yeah, this kind of developed the famous Duke Ellington quote. He said, I am beyond category, or
right.
You know, and I feel the same way. It's either, he said, there's two kinds of music. There's good music, and there's the other kind of music. You know, I mean, I say classical, and I say jazz. They're very loose, you know, terms, but I feel equally comfortable in both. Because when I got the idea to do the Nutcrackers, a very old friend of mine, Art Barron, who's a trombone player, who I've known for several decades, been trying to get me into Ellington for a long time. I said, well, fine, bring some stuff over. So he brought over a whole pile of LPs, and I was flipped through it, and I said, Nutcracker, wait, put this on. Mm-hmm. And I put it on, I said, I'm doing this. And I was thinking about it, and I said, you know, maybe I could do the original Tchaikovsky orchestra version. And there's nobody, I'm sorry to say this, there's nobody in the world, I think, who would try to conduct both of these pieces, you know. And I thought, well, if anybody can do it, you know, I think I can do it. Well, logistically and musically, I mean, they were done completely separately. I did not have the facility to do both of them on the same concert, and I wouldn't do it both of them on the same concert. It's switching hats, you know. So these things just kind of evolve, you know. And I meet somebody and say, oh, I play such and such. I go, I got an idea. I get ideas all the time. If I recorded and performed everything I had an idea for, you know, I'd have 1,000... you know, records at this point.
Well, it's interesting. I had thought, you just corrected me, that when you start to work with other musicians from other disciplines, be they jazz musicians, that's where ideas come in. I thought, well, maybe you structure ideas depending on who you're working with. And I was thinking, oh, the Sketches of Spain. Oh, you're working with the late Lusoff.
Yes.
I thought of him, and maybe he came up with the idea, but it wasn't him at all. It was this guy from St. Peter's who just put the idea in your head.
No, he didn't give me, I thought of it. This is Ronnie White. He just said, what do you want to do next year?
Oh, in Houston.
And I thought,
and
I said,
did it because of Lou, or?
No,
or was it get the idea and then get Lou? I mean, card before
I
the
did.
Horse.
I did, yeah. So I knew Ronnie, we had done Gershwin there, and he said, well, what do you want to do next year? I said, well, let me think about it. He said, how about Sketches of Spain? And he went, wow, Sketches of Spain, you know. Who are you going to get? I said, I don't know, let me work on it, you know. And I was put in touch with, as I said, the Gil Evans' wife. And she mentioned several people, one of which was Lou. And make a long story short, so again, the aforementioned Art Barron, my friend, the trombone player, he says, I'm very good friends with Lou, you know, because I was kind of intimidated, you know.
Okay.
So I can't remember how he did it, but he got us in touch with each other. And when I told Lou that Bernie Glow was my uncle. He said, I'm not charging you for this. And I said, well, he's not my blood uncle. He was a very close friend of my family, so I called him Uncle Bernie. I had forgotten that, you know, and I'm still in touch with his daughters, which is, you know, amazing. So that changed my life meeting Lou, because we did sketches. I just looked at the CD. I can't believe it's almost 10 years, which is incomprehensible. And then, you know, I got the idea to the Ellington. So he would help get me the band, and he was very, very careful about who he would get for which style of music. I said, what guitar player do you want? He said, well, you know, so-and-so. What bass player do you want? He says, no, you don't want that. I'll get you somebody. And he would call these guys up and say, look, you know, it's not a lot of money. I mean, I always do everything through the union. Not a lot of money, but this guy's good. He's doing a great project. Come on. So he would get these incredible people. You know, some people would get the CD, and they said, guy, you know who's in this band? You know, this is all, like, topical. So I don't know, you know. And I became friends with all these jazz guys, and they would say, I can't believe I'm friends with you. I said, I can't believe I'm friends with you either. So I had two completely separate bunches, you know, of people, the classical people, you know. But as a French horn player, I don't do that anymore. In New York, you get called to do a lot of different things. My wife and I, to go back, I played in the American Symphony for 20 years. I was assistant principal horn in the American Symphony with several years under Stokowski. And a couple of years in, 1974, we were hired out to go on tour with Rick Wakeman, Journey to the Center of the Earth. I didn't know what it was at the time. And we went on this 5-week tour. And we were rock stars. We had our own private jet. It was a 45-piece orchestra, a chorus, dancers, and the rock band. And we lived like kings for a month, you know. It kind of got me out of my hippie life, at least temporarily. But I met my wife, who is a violinist. Her name is Katsuko Esaki. So that changed my life also. And I, you know, recently I went online. I kept saying, you got to call up Channel 7 in New York, ABC, because that concert was recorded and broadcast in 74. The thing is, nobody had videotape in those days. I think that was a little bit too early. If I had had a play, I would have just popped a cassette in there and recorded it. So there's one version on the internet from Australia, which is obviously not us. And I finally found half of our broadcast, which I remember very clearly was recorded in Toronto. And it's not very good quality, but there I am, you know, in 74 with the whole thing, with the hair and the beard and everything, you know. But I listened to it, I said, hey, you were pretty good. You know, it's like, maybe you should start playing again, you know.
Does that make it on the list of things that might find resurrection through harmony?
I thought about that. You know, Rick Wakeman, who was, he was about 21 or 22 on that tour, and he had some health issues. Every time we would get into a new city, he would go to the hospital and get checked out. I thought, I hope this tour, you know, lasts, you know, and I hope he lasts. But I Googled him recently. He's like 65. He's got 4 or 5 kids, and he's been doing all kinds of stuff and everything. So all I'm saying is, in New York, you get to do a lot of different kinds of things. And I feel comfortable in all this stuff, you know.
The bold move by my guest, Stephen Richmond, to record the iconic Miles Davis jazz album of Gil Evans arrangements and originals called Sketches of Spain, turned out to be a winner. Here are a few moments from the well-known slow movement of Joaquin Rodrigo's famous Concierto de Aranjuez. The solo trumpet is played by the late Lou Soloff. Thank you.
So you're getting this pool of musicians who are talented in many different ways, different styles, and you're getting the advice to, hey, this... But you're the idea guy. So was the Henry Mancini Peter Gunn your idea? Because that really threw me when I saw that recording. I mean, I run a big band. We play the theme for every... You know, the theme from Peter Gunn, everybody knows.
Right.
But all the other music... I mean, so there has to be a story behind that.
Again, that's one of those things that popped into my head. I don't know exactly how it popped into my head. I mean, I have my original record of that from when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I mean, you could kind of say over these last few projects, I'm kind of reliving my childhood. Because one was from 58, two were from 1960, blah, blah, blah. But I don't know how I get these ideas. But I got the idea to do Peter Gunn. And let me see now. I wish I could remember how I was put in touch again with the Mancini family that I neglect to mention that before. And I met... Ginny Mancini, and she was a singer. She was a, you know, a kind of a studio singer. I mean, in the 40s, she sang in with Mel Torme. She's 90-something years old, you know, so I got this idea, and somebody put me in touch with her. So she lives in, you know, in L.A., and they said, well, you know, she has a place in New York also. I said, okay, so they gave me the phone number, I guess. No, I sent her an email. And I said, I don't know if you, by any wild chance, are going to be in New York, but we're doing... all this music, you know, from, and now, as you said, everybody knows the theme.
Yeah.
Boom, 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 boom. I met a guy from Thailand. He says, oh, yes, I know that, you know. It's ubiquitous, you know, but almost nobody knows that there's at least an hour and a half of gorgeous stuff that he wrote and arranged. So I said, by the way, we're doing this concert. I know you're in California, but we're doing it on such and such day and Wednesday. I mean, she said, my place is right around the corner from that church, and I'm going to be in this week. And this email kind of jumped off the page at me because she said, how cool is that? Now, she was 92 when she wrote this to me. So she came to the concert, and some interesting things happened. I was wearing a blue suit. She was wearing some sort of a peachy orange thing. And somebody, after the concert, brought the original LP up to her to sign. And we held it up to take a picture together, and it matched the, you know, the cover of the LP. It was, you know, how these crazy things happen. So she was extremely enthusiastic about it, and she was thanking me. I said, look, this is, like everything else I do, this is a labor of love. And she wanted us to go out to L.A. to do it, but unfortunately that, you know, that didn't work. But we're still in touch. She's on the board of everything in L.A., and she's just a fabulous lady. I love meeting the families, you know, because... as close as I can get, you know.
There's an interesting fact in the liner notes to the Mancini. You know, he had a band out there, which, but the piano player in his band was John Williams.
Yes,
and
Johnny Williams.
Johnny Williams at that time.
He was in his 20s or something.
Yeah, but I mean, people don't realize how all this stuff interconnects, and these people cross paths, and you know, and Mancini wasn't writing; it was jazz, but he had to make it palatable to a much wider audience. This was the first time that audiences would hear some of these rhythms. I mean, some of these people in some parts of the country, jazz was just the music that took place in the big cities.
From their recording of music Henry Mancini composed for the late 1950s TV Private Eye series Peter Gunn, the first such program to incorporate music in the jazz style, here is the famous theme, followed by the track called The Brothers Go to Mothers. The Harmonie Ensemble New York is led by their founder and music director and my guest today, Stephen Richman. We'll be right back.
okay, let's round back. You were talking about the Gershwins before, because it's your ideas. It's hard to put a thumb on what's going to come next from Harmony. Are there things that rank? Is it finding some kind of original source? Is it just the repertoire that gets you in your head? Or is it American music? I mean, all these factors seem to play into what you choose to do.
All right, well, I'll try to back up a little bit. This may or may not be an answer to your question. When I spent a decade working on Dvorak, Dvorak lived in New York City in the 1890s and wrote the famous New World Symphony on 17th Street, and the Cello Concerto, and some people sort of vaguely know it. I got involved in that whole thing with trying to save the house. We lost it, but I did a series of benefit concerts to help put up a statue of Dvorak in Stuyvesant Square Park, which is across the street where he lived. I did a lot of concerts. I met a lot of people. I had the Dvorak family to my apartment for dinner. Nobody could believe that. And then something kind of interesting happened, which was the next few projects I worked on were Copland, Gershwin, and Ellington, with no particular plan. And then one day I realized Dvorak had taught the future teachers of those same three composers, which is kind of spooky because it was completely unplanned. Why this happened, I haven't got a clue. I go where, what's interesting. In terms of asking me what's new and on the agenda, I'll tell you something totally different than what we're talking about. I have a recording coming out in a month on Bridge Records, which is a Toscanini 150th anniversary celebration. The first classical record I ever got, I think, was on my 11th birthday. I grew up in the Bronx near Yankee Stadium, and I remember it being brought to the store by my parents. And I still have that record, Toscanini with NBC doing William Tell, his orchestration of the Skater's Waltz and Nutcracker Suite. And this kind of evolved also. And I've been studying Toscanini for a very long time. I mean, around 1980 or so, there was a little kind of Toscanini mafia. What I mean by that is there were three guys who had access to the original acetates that were cut in the studio. Rehearsals, hundreds of hours of rehearsals and live stuff, unbelievable. And now a lot of it has come out on CD, but in those days it was very different. So I finally got to do this, and it evolved. It wasn't my original idea to do a Toscanini thing. I just did a bunch of that stuff, and I said, I guess to organize it, we could call it a Toscanini 150th anniversary. And I thought, I'm not sure if this is a good idea, because I'm putting a bullseye on myself, because there are going to be inevitable comparisons. But right. I thought, like everything else, I'm going to go for it. So it's got on it Verdi's Aida Overture, which he wrote and never used. What is used in the opera is the famous Prelude, which is much more sedate. Toscanini's Carmen Suite, which is different from the usual Carmen Suite. Nutcracker Suite, which is as it is published. And the Skater's Waltz, which has this stupendous performance on his record. And I have like half a dozen or more recordings of the Skater's Waltz. And as long as you can play it in tune and you play it nice, it's great. But Toscanini makes it into the greatest piece you ever heard because he has these subtle tempo variations, which you could miss. I mean, years ago, I found out that he did that orchestration. Everybody else does this salon orchestra version. All the recordings you hear are basically just a beefed up string section of the salon orchestra version. But he did this full orchestra version. It's just, spectacular. So I got a copy of it, his manuscript, at the Toscanini collection at Lincoln Center. I got the original parts from NBC. Backing up about the Aida was that I have a CD of Toscanini only did it once, the Aida Overture. It was in 1940 with NBC. I still obviously have the CD. And I remember ordering a score. And my wife said, "Why are you ordering the score?" I said, "I don't know. I just want to see what it looks like. Who knows?" And that was like 30 years before that. It all kind of, comes together. I don't know what this mysterious process is. I have absolutely no idea. But it's a barn burner if you do it at the right tempo. Because I have heard another recording where they play it just kind of really bland and it's nothing. But you get the right tempo and his... So...
This isn't the first... I mean, the Copland disc had Toscanini's piano version of Esselon Mexico, which is like...
Yeah.
And it was something he did so he could learn the piece, but that got thrown onto the recording with Copland.
Yeah, I think of the two big pieces.
Yeah.
So I wanted to do Appalachian Spring as I worked with Copland and I did music for the theater. And then I knew Copland's assistant, Philip Ramey, who lives across the street from me. And he had all kinds of stories, which are printable and unprintable. But he said, there's a couple of pieces that are unpublished. There was an incomplete violin concerto, which he had been writing for Isaac Stern, but never completed. And Philip arrange that for piano and violin. And then I remembered about the Toscanini piano version of Copland El Sol Mexico. I thought, well, that would be interesting, you know. And then there was some other piece he came up with, a duet for violin and viola, yeah. You know, so I just sort of throw a little bit of fairly known stuff and then some interesting little spice, you know, to make it interesting. I mean, it just, but I don't plan these things.
That's becoming very obvious.
Turning to my guest, Stephen Richman and his Harmonia Ensemble New York performing Gershwin from their Harmonia Mundi released recording with Gershwin's Piano Concerto in F, featuring Lincoln Mayorga as soloist and the American in Paris, here is the overture to the 1931 musical Of Thee I Sing.
Recordings have gotten great reviews, and there's some incredible things said on them. Again, you're mining, going back to source material. There's a clarinet player in the group who played in Whiteman's band, not at the time of the Rhapsody in Blue, which is on the recording, but about 10 years later, 8 or 9 years later. Yeah. You mentioned before how some of the Gershwin we hear gets corrupted over the decades. Mm-hmm. And I think our listeners might be saying, how does that happen? I mean, it goes in the score, you play from the score. So maybe just start there and then how you try to correct that. But how do these bad habits and errors creep into music by a composer so loved and so well known?
Well, I'm going to back up a little bit. I'm going to tell you something. Everything gets corrupted.
That's true, okay.
You know, I was doing research at Lincoln Center years ago, and there was when they were working with microfilm, and there's a woman sitting next to me, and I said, what are you doing? You know, she said, oh, it's Mozart, you know. And I said, oh, it's in what? You know, keyboard works, and this is Urtex. She said, I'm comparing the Urtex, which is supposed to be the original, cleaned up version, versus the manuscript. All these things, you know, get in there. I'm going to come about sideways. So I didn't mention, actually, on this Toscanini thing, I did William Tell Overture. There's all kinds of changes, you know. It gets published, and then some editor thinks, well, it's written on Dantino, I'm going to change it to Andante. Why? You know, Rossini spoke Italian, you know. He changed articulations, you know, and there's a whole soli celli thing in the beginning, and I just try to put all the original stuff in there. But more important than all this technical stuff is style. I listen to the oldest possible recordings I can get. Again, I'm drunk around to Gershwin, so I know the Gershwin family. Some of them have passed by. By the way, Gershwin's composing studio was in the next building to me on around the corner.
Wow.
Yes, he lived on 100. Well, he lived a lot of places, but he lived on 103rd off Riverside, and there's a plaque there. I almost rented a studio in there recently, but somebody else got it for me. But he composed in the Whitehall Hotel, which is literally next door, you know, over here. Did I ever answer your question? I tend to ramble.
Well, just how these habits and errors and things creep in to music we think we know so well. What do you do to correct them?
As I said, I mean, I went back to the original manuscripts. They have since been published. And I just go through there and correct as much as I can, which, I mean, it's my addition, because sometimes somebody's correction will be okay.
Right.
You know, because he wasn't that experienced in orchestral writing, for instance, in Concerto 1F. But style is everything. You can correct anything as long as you want, but style is everything. And when I started doing this 30 years ago, I met everybody who was alive who knew Gershwin. I was friends with Kay Swift, who was his assistant slash whatever you want to say. And Kay was an astounding woman. I meet all these people when they're 90. But she was sharp as a tack. I mean, she sat where you are sitting, and we had her over for dinner, and she had all these, you know, fantastic stories. But tempo and style are so important. And Gershwin is ubiquitous. It's all over the world. But it's treated as kind of pop music. And when conductors start interpreting things, Stravinsky always said, I hate conductors who interpret. Just play what I wrote. It's not that you're going to play it with no emotion, you know. But style is just, it's so important. And tempos, in general, have gotten miraculously slower over the centuries. We would think, oh, this is a faster world. You go back and listen to old recordings, I mean, they're much faster than what's going on today. I mean, you can watch an old movie where they're playing something, you know, and that from the 1930s, they go, my God, you know, I never heard it like that. And it's just so fresh. That's part of my approach, is that it should sound like it's the ink is still wet on the page.
Well, you also shine a spotlight, the recording that is all the Ferdi Groffet arrangements, if you will. I mean, there's a half-truth in that many people's ear version of what they hear and know as Gershwin, some of that they have to thank the Groffet, a lot of it, if they know only, you know, some Gershwin. And you pay tribute to that, and I thought that was a great idea. But again, sort of taking somebody out of the shadow a little bit. Again, your idea.
Well, I had seen Al Galadoro. Now, Al Galadoro was soloist with the Paul Whiteman Orchestra, as you mentioned, from the 1930s to the 1960s. So he didn't get to play the premiere of Rhapsody in Blue, which is in 1924, but he was like the third guy to do it. And we did another project. They're all interconnected. I did a Groffet record, and the original Grand Canyon Suite and Mississippi Suite were written for Paul Whiteman Orchestra. And Groffet and Whiteman had been associated since like 1919. So I had seen Al Galadoro on some kind of a television thing years and years ago. And I thought, yeah, get in touch with this guy. So somebody somehow had connected me with him, and he recorded a piece on my Groffet record, a piece that Groffet had written for him called Galadoro's Serenade for alto saxophone and piano. And again, he was like 92 or something when I met him, and like sharp as a tack. I mean, you know, he said, what else are we doing on the program? I said, I'm doing the Gershwin Second Rhapsody, but in Groffet's arrangement, which nobody knows. And he said, oh yeah, I recorded the Second Rhapsody with Whiteman, 1938, Liederkranz Hall. You know, so he had forgotten, you know, nothing. So after we did that concert, I was walking out of the hall, and I'm talking to his manager. I said, Joanne, can Al still play the Rhapsody? He said, oh yeah, sure, no problem. I said, I got an idea. So I always pulled somebody out, you know, from someplace or something, and I said, okay, we are going to do the original so-called jazz band version of the Rhapsody with Al. Now, Al played alto sax, clarinet, and bass clarinet. He could play absolutely anything. He came from that golden age of stupendous musicians. Jimmy Dorsey called him the greatest saxophone player who ever lived.
Oh.
And from Jimmy Dorsey. So I started planning this, you know, this concert and record. We almost always perform before we record. It's very difficult to go into a studio cold on this kind of music. And he had a little bit of a problem. He played funny, you know. I mean, we had several takes on one of the arrangements that we did, you know, and I had like six takes, and they just got funnier and funnier. Who plays funny anymore? You know, if you could hear it, I mean, you'd see. Yeah. So I picked what I thought was, you know, the funniest. But having him in the section, I mean, he's like a living legend. You know, I had some of these guys in there. Some of the guys weren't that young, you know, but they said, you got to help Galadoro do this thing, you know. I said, yeah, you know. And so he played the Rhapsody, and then I found these, there are arrangements that Groffé had done for Whiteman of Gershwin tunes, and I picked my 7 favorite. There's another 100 of them I could do. And then another thing where I go back to the originals is that Gershwin wrote the I Got Rhythm Variations for a tour in 1934. It was a Rhapsody in Blue 10th anniversary tour. And they played a lot of cities in, you know, on the East Coast. K. Swift thought that's what really did him in, but that's another story. And Gershwin orchestrated it. He wrote it for, it was about a 32-piece orchestra. Mitch Miller was the oboe player, by the way. After his death, they decided they were going to expand this out for a full symphony orchestra. You know, I had a recording of Arthur Fiedler and who's the pianist he did all that stuff with? Earl Wilde. I have this recording, which I had gotten again when I was in high school, with Earl Wilde and Arthur Fiedler. And, you know, it's wonderful stuff, but I always kind of unconsciously, instinctively felt there was something not right about it, either the style or was whatever it was. And then when I found out, it was written for a much smaller orchestra. And I got a hold of materials. I actually performed that in the 1980s. I did it within 2 days of Tolson Thomas. Yeah. He did it in L.A. and I did it in New York. I don't know which one of us did it first. So I thought this would be a great piece to put on this record too. And that was the first recording of the original version. And again, besides the size and details of blah, 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 I mean, it's style. There is a live recording of Gershwin doing it. He had a radio show in the 1930s. And I use that as kind of a reference point. And you get a completely different perception of what Gershwin was about. I mean, he was a genius. He was friends with Schoenberg and Alban Berg and Ravel. They took him seriously. And everybody thinks, oh, I'm going to do a Pops concert with Gershwin. It was part of my thrust was to change everybody's opinion about it. Frankly, I didn't expect people to get it. I didn't think anybody would get it. And a lot of people said, finally. I said, well, thank you, you know, because I don't make any money on this. This is a labor of love. I think, well, at least I can change people's minds around the world about Gershwin and all these other composers.
More Gershwin, but from a recording of Gershwin's music in orchestral arrangements for the Paul Whiteman Band by Ferdy Groffé. Here's my guest, Stephen Richmond, leading the Harmonie Ensemble New York in Sweet and Lowdown.
Thank you.
all these projects you've done, be they the Pinnacle of Gershwin, all these other projects, I mean, it also bespeaks your discerning, your connections, but also your discerning ear of just having the right musicians, because that comes through in the recordings, that they love what they're doing. You guys are of one mind, which is good, and that really comes through. So, you know, we'll look forward to the Toscanini, and I wouldn't even say you got a bucket list or something, because I think you just go from idea to idea. It seems that way anyway.
I have a list of about 50 projects that I would like to do. I'll tell you the next thing I'm working on. We're doing a concert in New York of Claude Thornhill arrangements.
Oh, wow, cool.
Yeah, again, my original idea was, you know, doing the classics. I mean, there's a Brahms Hungarian dance. There's a Greek piano concerto. But there's a lot of other stuff, too. I mean, there's Kurt Weill's September Song. And it was very difficult getting the music, because what often happens with these big band guys, you know, is that when they're retiring, whatever, they will donate their library to some university. Now, at least we have the internet now, but until several years ago, nobody knew where anything was. Right. You know, now you can go zing, you know, my librarian, he finds things. So I thought it's a great idea. Don't try to do these Thornhill things. I love these arrangements. And they're in a university in Missouri, Drury University. And often it goes to the library. It's not the music department.
Right.
So they don't exactly understand what they've got there. They were very nice. They said, we can't do this until the end of the semester. So that's like a few months. And I finally got this stuff, and I gave it to my librarian. He says, there's parts missing, there's a score missing, which is similar to what we did with the Gershwin arrangements, but I had 6 months or a year I was working on that. So there were a lot more things that I would have liked to have done, but I don't have enough time because the concert is in a month. So I decided I'm going to do the Ellington Peer Gynt.
Oh, okay.
Which we had done on a previous concert, which is unusual for me. I don't usually, you know, repeat things. But I'm really excited about this Claude Thornhill stuff.
Yeah, we should say, for people who don't know or remember him, I mean, one of the more striking things was his instrumentation of French horns, but bassoons, yeah, and all this kind of stuff,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
all
yeah.
In a big band, a swing, post-swing.
Well, yeah, I mean, Gil Evans and Jerry Mulligan did arrangements for him also.
Yeah, there you
know?
Go. Yeah.
I'll tell you a little side thing of this. I went up to Tanglewood a couple of weeks ago. I have one friend from high school. She's a flutist, lives up in Toronto, and we were talking about the old days. And I said, gee, I wonder what happened to Mr. Fink, the orchestra conductor. So I Googled him, and I found him. He had written an article for the Juilliard Journal. I didn't know he was a bass player, went to Juilliard. Anyway, long story short, I tracked him down, and he's been retired up in Lenox, Massachusetts. He says, you ever come up to Tanglewood? I said, I haven't for a long, long time. So I saw him, and he's 94, another one of them. And he said, well, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm doing this. I said, I don't know if you know this guy. I'm doing this Claude Thornhill. He's Claude Thornhill. Yes, he used French horns. The first guy to use French horns.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's 94. I love these old people because they've got incredible, you know, memories, and they were there.
Well, you sort of cornered the market on rounding back with people over the age of in the 90th. Jerry? What do they call that? Forget the word.
Not a Jerry.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Well, keep going. I mean, all these projects are really great, and they're fun to have. So, wish you years more. I mean, you know, we've got 40 coming up. So you have to plan something. You have to really mine that bucket list for 2 years from now. You hit 40.
All we need is financial help. It always comes down to the bottom line.
Yeah.
It's getting harder and harder.
The idea to get the family members on stage would be really cool.
That would be really astounding, wouldn't it?
I close all my Cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two quick questions, and the first is a hypothetical, which says, if you could chat like we've been chatting with someone for the past, I idea who it might be, but so we never had a chance to. What's the first name?
Gershwin.
It would be Gershwin.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. He is one of those, I always put him in the same boat with Schubert, that if, the big ifs, right? You know, mm-hmm. would he have gone, you know, stage with film music, more musicals, who mm-hmm. knows what he would have created, a whole different American concert scene of music. So
yeah, Gershwin kept saying, he says, you know, I've got this symphony in my head, I haven't got time to write it down. Yeah, you go, ah,
yeah,
you know, what if. But there's a certain bizarre similarity with Bizet and Mozart, who also died in their 30s.
Yeah,
well, that was a enormous tragedy for American
music. But I just put
him
with Schubert because it's like where they were going. Mm-hmm. You could see, yeah, Mozart, yes, very tragic, and much more music would have come from Mozart. Mm-hmm. But Schubert was going in places where people weren't thinking even at that point, as Gershwin was. Final question is non-musical. Everybody I interview in Cadenza fills their life with music. You're very busy just keeping the ideas straight. When you have to do something that's non-musical, take yourself away from it, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, what do you do?
Oh,
gosh. Step away, a little respite.
Well, you know, people always say, oh, who's your favorite composer? Mm. Which is, and the standard answer with any musician will say to you, whoever I'm working on at the moment.
Right.
So when you're a musician, it's not a job. It's not something you slow down or retire from. I'm hearing music in my head all the time. We are fortunate. I have a nice place up in Connecticut, you know, go up there. I was originally an English major. I read mostly about music, you know, these days. I love old movies. I grew up near Yankee Stadium. I'm a huge Yankee fan. Mm. Like to eat. Good food. I belong to a health club, you know. I swim and I take Tai Chi and work with a trainer. You know,
try so you to two are moving. Shooting for 90 plus.
as long as I can still work.
Thanks for taking some time.
Thank you.
Founder and music director of Harmony Ensemble New York, Stephen Richman. You can find out more about him and the ensemble at their website, Harmony, Harmonie, EnsembleNY.com. Their most recent recordings are being released on the Harmonia Mundi USA label. Check them out at harmoniamundi.com. Next Wednesday, September 20th at 1 p.m., if you happen to be up on the east side of Midtown Manhattan, stop in for a concert by my guest and his group, a concert of arrangements of classical music from the likes of Brahms, Dvorak, and Grieg, etc., by the arranging likes of Duke Ellington, Billy Strayhorn, Gil Evans, and the man my guest just spoke of, Claude Thornhill. It is at St. Peter's Church, 619 Lexington Avenue at 54th Street, part of their Midtown Jazz at Midday series. That was the famous opening of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, the clarinet glissando lick performed by Al Galadoro, who played in the Paul Whiteman Band in the 1930s. I'll leave you with the final moments of that same performance by the Harmony Ensemble New York, featuring Lincoln Mayorga as soloist, led by their founder, music director, and my guest today, Stephen Richman. And as always, I'm glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you. And thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.